Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education. So are you the parent of a child on the autism spectrum? If so, you're going to want to check out our chat with one of the physicians heading up the Spark for Autism study right here at Yale. We're going to explain the study, why it's poised to reveal groundbreaking data, and clue you in on how to get involved. Then we're going to check in with the Connecticut League of Conservation Voters on the heels of the group's latest environmental summit, and we're going to review their agenda for bills they hope to see passed in this year's state legislative session, which opens this week. We're also going to talk about aspirations for another guest. We're going to close with our contacts at the State Office of the American Lung Association. We'll be reviewing the 2020 State of Tobacco Control Report to learn how the federal government, and especially Connecticut, can do more to protect kids. And we'll be hearing about their roadmap to address Connecticut's youth e-cigarette epidemic, as well as plans for the upcoming legislative session and the Lung Association's agenda. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Hey, did you hear? Approximately 1,100 Access Health CT consumers are going to be receiving an orange envelope in the mail. It's important that consumers review this information carefully, as they're going to need to take action to enroll in free services being offered to help protect their personal information that may have been compromised in a data breach. In addition to the mailing, and to help ensure affected consumers do not disregard any mailing, Access Health CT is also going to be contacting these consumers in a multi-layered outreach effort, including phone calls and emails, to alert you to look for that orange envelope in the mail. Consumers can also call Access Health CT for more information, or if you have any questions. The number is toll-free, 855-805-4325. That's 855-805-4325 for Access Health CT. So, full disclosure, I've already had the opportunity to talk with our guest this morning, as I kind of met her by phone earlier in the week and was able to reel her in to chat on the radio. And I'm really excited about that, because we have talked for so many years about the challenge that individuals on the autism spectrum have, and the challenges that their parents and caregivers have to kind of understand a little bit about why things are the way they are. So I'm so pleased to make the acquaintance of Dr. Abha Gupta. She is the assistant professor of pediatrics at Yale, and her clinical and research interests are in autism spectrum disorder, especially regressive conditions like childhood disintegrative disorder. She obtained her postdoctoral research training in the genetic investigation of ASD. As a principal investigator, she's pursuing both the genetics and neurobiology, which is the stem cell modeling of ASD. I want to call her Dr. Gupta, because she's not just an MD, not just an MD, but a PhD. I've learned that her passion is in the genetics. So, but we're not going to dig too deep into the weeds on the science about this morning. Yeah. I met her over the fact that she is a point person with the Spark for Autism study at Yale. Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Gupta, thank you for joining us.
Of course.
So this is your excitement was palpable when I talked to you on the phone the other day about the Spark study and about your work. Just tell us a little bit more about your background and why of all of the spectrum of things that you could go into as a pediatric research specialist, you decided genetics and autism were going to be the path you follow.
Yeah, that's a good question, because it was a little bit of a windy path. I have always been interested in cognitive neuroscience and neuropsychiatric disorders. And when I was a graduate student in the neuroscience department many years ago, I really tried to seek out a thesis lab to study the biological basis of psychiatric disorders. But 20 some years ago, the research was still pretty primitive. And I was kind of advised to stay away from it, actually, because it would be very hard to formulate a hypothesis, do a thesis, get out in time. So I ended up, veering toward, of all things, ophthalmological disorders. But I always came back to the idea of doing research in neuropsychiatric disorders, because for me, the brain is in the final frontier. It's the most mysterious organ, the one we know the least about. And kind of I had a philosophical bent to it, too. Like, I really was interested in the biological basis of consciousness, kind of one of those big, universal questions was what really got me going. And then I happened to read like a one-page magazine article on autism. And I have to say, during my graduate years, I didn't know anybody with autism. I didn't have a family member affected by autism or a friend and nothing like that. I'd never met a person with autism, but I was just very fascinated by how this condition impacts some of our most human abilities, in terms of like emotional skills, social skills, and what that meant for the underlying biology. So after finishing my thesis in this ophthalmology lab, I decided I really wanted to pursue developmental behavioral pediatrics, because where I trained, those were the specialists who saw kids with autism, and that I wanted to really dedicate my life to this condition to understand, the genetics and the neurobiology. So I went on to do a general pediatrics training at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and doing a fellowship there and also at Yale, which is where I completed it, specialty training in developmental pediatrics. So I see kids in clinic with autism, and I've come to appreciate what an impact this diagnosis has on families. And it really informs my research program, which again focuses, like you said, on the genetics, but also the neurobiology of autism. Having had a neuroscience background as a PhD student and having had postdoctoral training in the genetics of complex human disorders, I really, really aim to bridge those two fields to understand what's going on in autism in the brain.
Well, it was right about that time, 27, 28 years ago, when experts in the field of autism across the board, mm-hmm. scientists, doctors, researchers, were starting to kind of all collectively point to the tsunami that mm-hmm. was coming. And it was just a few years later when we started to see, one in, 800, then one in 400, mm-hmm. and then one in 200. And then, oh my God, the numbers, it started just like spiraling out of control. So let's bring it around to the inception of mm-hmm. the research that has been labeled now the SPARC study for autism.
Yeah, so, it is quite a mystery why the prevalence is going up, and everyone is looking for, what is causing this, because that's the only way we're going to be able to, develop treatments, targeted treatments. It's going to be based on the biology. So there has been evidence, it's been well established for a long time, that there is a genetic contribution to autism. So I think any human geneticist in the field would admit to you that there's probably an interaction between genetic susceptibilities that people are born with and also environmental triggers that we are not at all clear about. Investigating the genetics of autism is a really important way to tackle it. It's not the only way, but it's an important way, because we do know there's a lot of familial evidence that there is a genetic contribution. So the Simons Foundation,
they're curing cancer now with genetics, so why not autism? Mm-hmm. Let's make autism next. Come on.
It's such a huge research effort, and it's so worthwhile. It's so needed, and I can tell that just from my clinic. I'm so frustrated when parents of my patients ask me, know, what causes this? What will treat this? Is there a cure? And I just wave my hand saying, you know, I'm not having any good answers. So that's why I'm so passionate about the research aspect of this, is that I want to be able to give these parents better answers than I have right now. Mm-hmm. So that's why, you know, all the effort. But
well, you can now, I was going to say, you can now look to those parents and say, I don't have the answers, but you may be able to help contribute toward me finding them by being part of this Spark study.
Yes, we really emphasize to parents how, like, none of this research would be possible without participation of families. And that's really what powers the research. Of course, you need, you know, the scientists, the researchers, the funding, but none of this would be possible without families participating. It's so important for us to be able to understand autism. So the Simons Foundation funds this SPARK study. It stands for Simons Powering Autism Research and Knowledge. And it, I believe now it's in its fourth year, coming up on its fifth year. This program, there are about a couple dozen sites across the entire country, and the purpose is to recruit about 50,000 families affected by autism. You know, the genetic studies that have been done, have been published, have focused on a few thousand families. Lately, there's a much bigger study with about 30,000 families, which is great. But I think the reason why we haven't completely solved, you know, understood the genetics of autism is because we haven't studied enough families to see all the patterns that could be there in terms of genetics. So we need to really increase our subject numbers, and that only comes through being able to interest families and recruit them for these studies. So SPARK aims to collect saliva samples, which is, you know, much easier than blood draws. I'm trying to make this as easy as possible for families to participate, to collect saliva samples from the, you know, child affected by autism. It doesn't have to be a child. It could be an adult, an individual affected by autism, and preferably both biological parents, although it's not, you know, always necessary. We'll take all participants. And the point is that the saliva that's, you know, spit into a tube, is sent back to the lab, and we do what is called whole exome sequencing, maybe even whole genome sequencing in the future, where we're looking basically for where are the mutations, just asking simply, you know, what genes are being affected, what could be underlying autism, looking at the patterns and trying to understand the genetic basis for this. And if we recruit enough families, that, you know, we should be able to start finding those patterns.
Great. We're a little bit more than halfway through our chat with Dr. Abha Gupta. She's with the Yale SPARK for Autism Study, which is, as we heard, coming off of the Simons Foundation Powering Autism Research and Knowledge. So, Dr. Gupta, there's several dozen partners in leading medical schools across the United States. Mm-hmm. Can you talk just for a few moments about how all of these very esteemed educational and medical centers are coordinating over this, and how that camaraderie and collaboration all is going to contribute toward a better outcome?
Yeah, so collaboration is the key in this day and age, for sure. To be able to conduct such large studies, you need multiple groups collaborating and cooperating with each other instead of, you know, being isolated and in silos. So this could only be possible when you have multiple, you know, medical centers, institutions working together. So there is an annual meeting for the heads of the study at each site, where there's, and for study coordinators, to gather and exchange a lot of ideas about how to interest families and recruit them. And they can be some misconceptions out there about, you know, genetics research, and, you know, so we really try to educate each other on what works best in how to educate families, how to spread the word, how to do successful recruitment, and we learn a lot that way by talking to each other. So, you know, when we go back home, we use those tips and techniques and strategies to do our own outreach in our local areas, and for us, you know, it includes recruiting patients through our own clinics, for example, in pediatrics and at the Child Study Center, but also reaching out to pediatric practices, providers of services and therapies for individuals with autism all around the state. And so we've done, this has been our first year on the SPARK project at Yale, and we've done a lot of work, a lot of infrastructure building and forming relationships. I should also mention, really, that I have a partner in crime in this. His name is Dr. Roger Joe. He's a child psychiatrist at the Child Study Center, and both of us are directing this project at Yale, and he deserves a lot of credit for, you know, his relationship building around the state. And that's because of, you know, I mentioned the last time that he directs something called Project CASY, C-A-S-Y, which stands for Community Autism Socials at Yale, yeah. Where he tries to set up social events, which have been really well received by the community for, you know, individuals with autism and their parents to get together and socialize. And so we're leveraging that infrastructure as well, where we are going to sites around the state. It used to be we were kind of hovering around New Haven, but we're using this funding in part to be able to reach out to a lot of other communities. As you know, we were in Newtown just last weekend to offer not just, you know, information to families, but also invite them to these social events through CASY. And also at the same time, educate them about SPARC, you know, give them the information and you know, to interest them in participating. So it's a really, you know, a two-way street. And that's what we would like to make it, instead of just a kind of a dry, straightforward, you know, research involvement to you know, have an exchange.
Personal interaction, sure.
And that goes a long way, yeah.
So there's sort of a benchmark deadline coming up at the end of February, which is giving us the opportunity to really push the message out and try to get people involved, because they don't actually have to ever even leave their house to get involved in the study. They can go online and do a questionnaire. Yep. Everything is transacted through the mail in terms of the samples.
Yep.
And
completely free.
And it's not just free, maybe, right?
Yes. So no cost to the family for sure. But, you know, as a thank you, the families do receive a $50 Amazon gift card as a token of appreciation. But also, even, you know, on top of that, if there is a mutation that's been identified in a gene that's been associated with autism, then the family does get those results returned to them, usually through their, you know, primary care doctor, so that they can get some information about, you know, the genetic studies that we're doing.
Mm-hmm. So are there any other planned outreach events or activities on the calendar between now and the end of February that you have set in stone yet?
Not right now. Actually, so there are a number of different ways to participate. As you mentioned, one is, like, you can do this entirely from home. Families can do that. Right now, we're concentrating on having families come in to our clinic to participate, and also for us to even do home visits, if that's easier for families. So at the moment, that's what we're concentrating on until we reach our benchmark. But I know that our study coordinators, the whole team, has been working hard to set up new events coming up at various places. I remember including with Vista, for example, which is a service provider. So I don't have the exact dates yet, but we can definitely convey them. But as I said, right now we're kind of concentrating on the bringing families in or going out to their homes to recruit for SPARC.
Fantastic. Dr. Abhka Gupta is with Yale and the Yale SPARC segment of this big autism research project. This landmark autism research project aims to make important progress possible in perhaps discovering a cure for autism. SPARC stands for Simons Foundation Powering Autism Research Knowledge. And the mission is simple. They just want to speed up research and advance understanding of autism to help improve lives, and that means involving you. If you're the parent of a child or a family member of an individual on the autism spectrum, you may qualify to be part of the study. SparkForAutism.org/Yale is where you can start, and you may have the opportunity to meet with Dr. Gupta and her fantastic team over there at Yale. Dr. Gupta, I want to thank you for helping promote this, and hopefully we'll be able to come back around and speak with you or one of your colleagues as things progress into the spring and summertime. Yeah. So thank you so much for being part of the program. Well, recently, the Connecticut League of Conservation Voters Education Fund and Trinity College Program on Public Values co-hosted the 20th Annual Environmental Summit, and those who attended, participated, and helped organize it say it was one of the best summits yet. Experts and advocates outlined key problems and offered solutions, to issues including PFAS and toxins, forest conservation, clean and equitable transportation, zero carbon energy, coastal climate resiliency, climate change education, even updating the bottle bill and our plastic and styrofoam problems. We're going to talk about a bunch of those because Lori Brown is on the line with us from the League. Lori, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, John.
So first of all, just a quick little bit of boilerplate so people understand what the Connecticut League is. You're not a division of the government, right?
No. We're a statewide nonprofit environmental advocacy organization. So we do political work on behalf of the environment statewide. So we work with all of the environmental groups from across Connecticut who have specific legislative initiatives they want to get passed, whether it's, you know, land, air, water, wildlife, climate, clean energy, transportation. Whatever the key issues are each year at the state legislature, we have a summit prior to every session where advocates gather alongside administration officials and lawmakers. And we set the table, in a sense, for what the agendas, what the big items are going to be. So everybody's starting out on the same page. And we've right. done this for 20 years now. So this was the 20th annual Environmental Summit. And it's also, by the way, the 50th anniversary of Earth Day.
There you go.
A big year for the environment.
Yep. And also every year you guys rate Connecticut's lawmakers through a scorecard system, which is also accessible on your website. And really the website handle says it all. It's conservationeducation.org. People can go there and learn more about the great work that the League is doing. And,
well, let me say also that the political side with the scorecard.
Yep.
You know, the meaty political stuff, if you really want to know what's going on with our lawmakers, what happened with legislation, what's the dynamic, and what have they got in front of them every year, that's the political arm, which is the ctlcv.org. So we have two arms. We have the political arm that does the scorecard, and all of our watch list and information and all the political work, the endorsements, all of that is on our ctlcv.org. We also have the side of our organization that is the CTLCV Education Fund, and that is the side that does the summit, that does the briefing papers, that are all the overviews of these key issues to get everybody sort of, very simple one-pagers,
sure.
whether it's the bottle bill or PFAS or pesticides.
So, thanks for clarifying that. That's good.
Yeah, we do have a very sort of unique niche in that we do political work. We endorse candidates that are good on the environment. We help get them elected, and then we count on them to do well and vote well and be our champions. It matters who's up there.
Very good. So, as we can't really adequately get into what's on the agenda as the Connecticut General Assembly session for 2020 opens this coming week, without looking back on last year's event, the summit, and what came out of that in terms of successes and maybe not so much with some other agenda items. Give us a quick recap on where we stand today based on looking back at last year's session.
Oh, yeah. You know, the summit in January of 2019 was really a turning point. I mean, that was where Governor Lamont came and made his first speech on the environment to the community at large at the summit. And he said he was going to look at everything through an environmental lens, and he was particularly focused on clean energy. And as a result, we had really turned the corner, I think, on a lot of our renewable and clean energy goals. And we had, you know, the largest offshore wind procurement in the nation that took place last session. And that was one of the things that we all worked very hard on. But also, we had fixed the damage that had been done to the, you know, rooftop solar, residential solar industry, the net metering fix. But we also, we passed a plastic bag ban last year, which is huge. That was huge and a lot of work, and it's so heartening to get those wins. And the other sort of major win in 2019 was the statewide water plan. So, and then one more thing is that late last year as well, the governor passed Executive Order 3, which is specifically to completely electrify our grid, our electric grid, by zero carbon by 2040. And at the same time, restart the GC3, which was the Governor's Council on Climate Change, that was put together under Malloy, but it was reestablished under this executive order in a way that is a much broader sort of focus, a broader range of stakeholders, you know, more than just, the technical policy insiders. It's really much broader in scope, and a lot more people are going to be involved in the subcommittees on making recommendations to the governor on how we're going to get to that zero carbon grid by 2040.
Well, it certainly sets up organizations like the Connecticut League of Conservation Voters in a good position for the coming 20 years as things lead up to that. It's great to create sort of a goal at the end of the tunnel, but do you think and envision that the hard work on this zero carbon initiative by 2040 is going to have to be at the starting point, or do you anticipate that there's going to be challenges and issues that make achieving that zero carbon goal by 2040 a challenging mission every year up to that date?
I think we all recognize the urgency of acting now, especially our youth. A lot of our youth are really finding their voices, they're standing up, and they're calling for big change. They really get climate change, and they get the fact that we've got, this is not easy. Nobody said it's going to be easy, but we don't have forever to fix our problems to be able to tackle climate change. But I think in particular, with the policies that need to be put in place, that's part of what the GC3 and everyone is going to hammer out. We do have, like I said, the offshore wind is a big push. That's a big step in the right direction. And we do have a lot of policies that have been put on the table over the years. I mean, to get us away from fossil fuel infrastructure is the goal, right? Get us towards a clean, new, green economy. And one of the things that Commissioner Katie Dykes did, we didn't know she was going to do this at the summit, but during her remarks, she made very clear that she believes, and the administration believes, that fracked gas, natural gas, is not a bridge fuel. It is a fossil fuel, and that's a big turn of direction because we are, as you know, battling against the killingly, investing for the next 20 years into natural, fracked gas infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So there's a big battle about that, and that was really an eye opener to hear her say that, which means that we are really getting that shift mentally away from natural gas as sort of like, okay, this is the bridge, it's better than oil, it's better than coal, let's just use that while we can afford it, make it reliable. No, that's out the window. I mean, even the environmental community was thinking that way, but it's been a real push to get us away from that framework and really demand the clean energy options. I mean,
Guess it's beyond people seeing low energy bills and thinking that gas is the cleanest environmental alternative, because you need to think beyond the delivery to the manufacturer of that material.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are all kinds of ways to get at this. There are market-based solutions that people know as, carbon pricing, and that really is on the way in different forms, whether it's through transportation or, we already have carbon pricing in a sense in our regional greenhouse gas initiative, REGGIE.
Yeah.
So people are working very hard on, how to do that similar type thing with transportation, which, arguably is the largest sector of greenhouse gas emissions. So all of these policies, I mean, we have the goals, they're set in our statutes now, and we need to keep fighting to make sure that our legislators don't just take half steps. I mean, we just don't have time for that.
Great. Well, we're going to keep fighting our way through this long punch list of things that we need to talk about in the closing 8 or 9 minutes that we have with you, Lori. We're going to take a quick break. Lori Brown is with us. She's with the Connecticut League of Conservation Voters Education Fund. ConservationEducation.org is their website. They also have information available at ctlcv.org if you're interested in really digging into how your state lawmakers are working toward or not working as hard as they might be able to toward environmental initiatives here in Connecticut. We'll be back with Lori Brown in just a few moments. Stick with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations that would love to have your support. You can learn about a number of them through LoveCT. And if you run, work for, or volunteer for a qualified nonprofit, apply now for a chance to receive a $5,000 radio contract to promote your event or brand. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to LoveCT to apply for the grant and to help the many causes. Is supported by Connoisseur Media. Hey, I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. February is American Heart Month, and according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States. Coronary artery disease is the most common form of heart disease, and a number of screening tests are available for this condition, including calcium scoring with cardiac CT. The Radiological Society of North America wants you to be informed about the ways in which heart disease can be detected early to ensure medical intervention has the best outcome. So the RSNA and the American College of Radiology encourages everyone to visit their free, patient-focused website offering information about radiologic tests, treatments, and procedures that could save lives. To learn more, just go to radiologyinfo.org. That's radiologyinfo.org. Well, we're back, and Lori Brown is with us. She's with the Connecticut League of Conservation Voters Education Fund. If you'd like to learn more about that initiative, you can go to conservationeducation.org. Coming off of their latest environmental summit, which just occurred recently, they have a raft of agenda items for the upcoming short session of the Connecticut General Assembly, which is starting later this week. Lori, you mentioned about how it is the younger generation that is becoming so energized toward environmental change and climate improvement. To that end, one of the agenda items that you guys want to tackle this year, it has to do with climate change education, right?
Yes, absolutely. And just in fact, just so you know, the youth Sunrise Movement is having a lobby day. So there's a youth climate lobby day on the 10th at the Capitol. So
10th of February? You
know, yeah, 10th of February. And so we'll be posting stuff about that. But right. I think that's just emblematic of just how much the youth is really throwing into this and how much effort. And we need to support that and let them lead the way because they really have a lot of really good initiatives that they're calling for. But the climate change education, I mean, like you said, there's committee bills this year. It's a short session, and all the committee chairs are really figuring out right now what their priorities are. So if people really have an interest in a particular piece of legislation, they should get in touch, look at our website, and we will be providing ways for people to get involved and get active. The climate change education bill is actually something that the youth is very interested in that it provides education on climate change in public schools to different grades. And right now, it's not a required, part of the curriculum. We only just fought to get it to be available as an elective. But this year, there's a big push to make it mandatory because we need to arm our youth. We need to prepare them for dealing with arguably is going to be the most devastating environmental issue that anybody is going to have to deal with for the rest of our lifetimes and next generations to come. So we need to prepare them. They need to be ready to jump into sort of a green-based economy in this changing, world that we're in, to have the tools to figure out the solutions to the problems that we have created. So climate change education needs to be raised in the education committee. And it's just very simple. It changes from a may to a shall. you shall include climate change education mm-hmm. in schools.
Got it.
That's it. That's just that simple. And so we're hoping that that will cross the finish line this year.
Well, if the easiest thing that Connecticut's General Assembly could do is change a may to a shall in one piece of in one law, then let's get going on that. The other thing yes. I wanted to touch on is something that really impacts every single person here in Connecticut, every single person certainly that's listening, and that is going to involve the League's initiatives on waste and recycling, and tied into that is the bottle bill.
Absolutely. And the bottle bill, people who have heard anything at all know that that is a huge struggle. Our recycling program, our deposit program, when it's working, it absolutely is essential. It is the landmark sort of recycling law. So the bottle bill has not been updated in like 30 years. And so what we really need to do with all these new types of containers and beverages that are perfectly recyclable, we need to expand our recycling program to include things like, you know, wine bottles, liquor bottles, sports drinks, things that right now don't have the deposit on them. And in fact, just 2 weeks ago, a poll came out from Greenberg Quinlan, which is a you know a national renowned pollster, that showed 81% of voters support expanding the state's bottle deposit program. That's a whopping. That was higher than most any other thing that was tested. Is people get it? They understand recycling is important. And now that our programs are failing only because legislators have not agreed on how to update the programs. So that's a big push this year. The you know, public wants it. They're perfectly capable of doing it, and it needs to happen. There's also the plastic and the styrofoam bans that we're looking at, or reducing those products. So the small things like the straws and the stirrers and other small plastic products that are such a huge problem for our wildlife and in the production of plastic is huge greenhouse gas emissions and toxics in the water. So these are things that the legislature needs and can address fairly easily. So those styrofoam containers, those can easily be replaced with other products. So that's going to be another part of sort of the waste, addressing some of our waste and recycling programs.
It just seems so ironic that something that a person might utilize or touch for mere seconds has so much environmental impact on the way to their hand and once it leaves their hand. And it's great to hear the League is tackling that issue with such great energy. Something else that has been in the news that people probably don't have as much of an understanding as they should is regarding the firefighting chemical, the PFAS.
Yes.
You know, certainly it has a great consensus around the issues that happened at Bradley Airport and the tragedy of the crash that happened there last year. But people can go a long, long way away from an airport and still be affected by PFAS, right?
Yes, it is a much bigger problem that has come to light than anybody ever thought. Apparently, there have been spills like this, particularly in military installations and all over, where the firefighting foam, there was an effort to ban the PFAS in the training foam. And, you know, just 3 days after the session ended and the legislature failed to act on it, that's when the big spill came out of Bradley into the Farmington River. Right after the river had been designated National and Historic Treasure, we had this problem, which then immediately the governor did had a task force that came out with the recommendations. And the extent of this problem, you know, the horrors of what it actually causes to human health and wildlife is just an eye-popper. And so it's not just the firefighting foam. It's in everything, everything that's got flame retardant. It's in your Teflon. It's in your cookware. It's in the food cans. It's in your clothing, your furniture. It's everywhere. And it has serious health implications. So the first thing we need to do is stem the flow. So we have got to get this, we have got to stop the productions. And believe me, there are industry lobbyists who are going to be fighting tooth and nail against anything that we were trying to do. So stay tuned on that one. But I think the momentum is there. We know that there's going to be legislation to certainly ban it in the firefighting foam, but also to start taking care of it in the ware, the spoons and knives and forks and things that and Teflon and things like that, yep, that we can try to block it there.
Very good. Well, everything from PFAS and toxins to forest conservation, clean and equitable transportation, zero carbon energy, coastal climate resiliency, climate change education, updating the bottle bill, and plastic and styrofoam recycling. It's all on the agenda with the Connecticut League of Conservation Voters Education Initiative. Lori Brown is their representative. ConservationEducation.org is where you can go to learn more about this work and how you might get involved in advocating to your lawmakers here in Connecticut as they get ready for their session. Lori, thanks for being part of the program and bringing us up to date on all this great work that you're doing with the league. So as we indicated in our intro, we have returned with our friend Ruth Canovi. She is the American Lung Association's Director of Advocacy here in Connecticut. She has been a regular and a great guest on the award-winning For the People. And today we come to you with the news that the State of Tobacco Control Report is available. And we're going to be talking today about some good news in regards to Connecticut's stance on tobacco, and also reiterate some information that we've covered in the past in terms of ways that we can do better. We're also going to be touching on the exploding concern of teen vaping and how the American Lung Association is working to try to educate and stem that epidemic and all of the unknowns involved with it. So, Ruth, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, just for folks that are not familiar, you know, they hear about the American Lung Association and they probably envision this big, huge national organization. But really, at the state level, you play a really important role in helping to kind of funnel information that is very much pertinent to the folks that live right here in Connecticut.
Yeah, well, thank you. Right. And so we have presence throughout the country. And so, I mean, our mission is to save lives by improving lung health and preventing lung disease. And so there's a lot of issues that come under that umbrella, but we do a lot of work to, right, like you said, spread the word about issues that impact people's lung health and try to improve it.
So we've been hearing a lot from the president on down about flavored vape substances and cartridges,
right,
and things. Obviously, this is something that was on your radar, on the Lung Association's radar for some time. Let's start our conversation there in terms of what is happening and what people need to know through the perspective of ALAC in regards to this epidemic, especially of vaping among teens, young kids. They are sucking this stuff down.
For sure. I mean, we know that these really, they hook kids, right? These flavors. And in 2009, the federal government actually acted to prohibit flavored cigarettes with the exemption of menthol. That helped with the cigarette product, and that was a time when these e-cigarettes weren't nearly as popular as they are today. We're seeing 15,000 different types of flavors. If you look, I mean, things from cotton candy to gummy bear to Pop-Tart to candy. I mean, if you look at just even the companies and what they sell, it's, you know, makes up a high majority. About 80% of their products are flavored. When we're looking at 15,000 things of these, and it's clear that they're aimed at kids. When you look at kind of, I think about 81% of kids who start using tobacco products use a flavored tobacco product. And so we're really concerned about these things. And it's how we're getting young people hooked. I mean, sadly, we saw such a reduction in cigarette smoking, right? And so we were implementing policies that we knew worked. And one of those was that change in what was available for flavors. but now with electronic cigarettes. And there still are some other kind of combustible tobacco products that we think need to be addressed when you look at those pineapple-flavored little cigars that are on sale for super cheap. Those types of things really kind of are enticing to kids and draw them in. And so the industry has been smart in doing that. And so we're looking at trying to prohibit those. And so it's something that on the federal level, the administration introduced guidance and said that kind of certain types of flavored tobacco aren't allowed, but it is far from comprehensive and really needs a lot of improvement. So in Connecticut, we'll be looking to prohibit flavored tobacco products in the state.
So in terms of the state of lung cancer, there's some other somewhat heartening information that kind of picks up on where we left off of on last year's report in terms of some of the effectiveness. But yet, on the other hand, the place where the biggest difference can be made, sadly, the allocation of funds to promote the work that the American Lung Association and so many others are doing toward the greater public health is not being diverted into those channels.
Right. And so, I mean, this year it's our 18th annual State of Tobacco Control Report. And I've been doing this for a number of years, and I am excited that we have an A this year. As you mentioned, we get an A in our Tobacco 21 policy. And that was a huge win for us. I think a lot of leaders in the state of Connecticut worked hard to make that happen. And it's a quality bill, and we're really excited about that and hoping that we can get some momentum there and take action on these other policies that we don't do so well in. And so, like you said, funding, that piece, since the fiscal year of 2015, we haven't put any money into the Tobacco and Health Trust Fund. And, you know, we've talked about this before, but we get money from the Master Settlement Agreement, and we also get money from our, you know, pretty high cigarette taxes. And so that's close to $500 million every year. And we think that we need to put some money into that to help prevent this new generation from being hooked on these products. Tobacco costs the state over $2 billion and, you know, healthcare costs to the actual state. And so more needs to be done. And so we think this is where prevention can, you know, it can really make a difference.
Yeah, I think the saddest and most ironic thing is while the state could take that money, it has a broad wherewithal as to how to apply those funds. Very little, a fractional amount is actually going toward awareness and education. I mean, they're not even diverting a measurable amount of those funds to offset the red ink in the public health care segment who are affected by tobacco-related illnesses, right?
Yeah, I mean, so one thing that the state does well is that they cover tobacco cessation services for the Medicaid population, and that's something that when we compare our other counterparts around the country, we definitely do better. So when we're looking at cessation costs within that healthcare realm, that's something that we do. But when we talk about prevention and investment in something that's called the Connecticut Quit Line, when people can call, you know, general public and just get help and assistance quitting, that's something that we've just not only not put any money into in the last 5 years, when you look historically, the amount of money that's been kind of grabbed from that fund and put into the general fund is really shocking. And so the CDC recommends that Connecticut spends $32 million on cessation and prevention services. And so when you look at that money and cumulatively look at that over the past 20 years or so since really that Tobacco and Health Trust Fund was created, it's been about $29 million. And that's with the last 5 years or so being nothing. And so, you know, we really need to take action. We are thrilled that people have kind of come around. I feel like a couple years ago we would be talking about tobacco issues and people are like, really, is that still a thing? You're like, very much so. But sadly, now the just epidemic level use, especially among young people, of tobacco products is really concerning. And so I think our leaders are recognizing that, and we're hoping that that can translate into continued action this year.
We're chatting with Ruth Canovi. She's the American Lung Association's Director of Advocacy here in Connecticut, chatting about the 18th annual State of Tobacco Control Report that grades states and the federal government on policies proven to prevent and reduce tobacco use. So Ruth, something that we've touched upon in previous conversations, but it bears reiterating, is that when it comes to breathing easier, one of the contributors against that is actually lurking in the environments where people live and work. Can we talk a little bit about the clean indoor air laws and why there's so much room for improvement there in regards to what Connecticut is doing?
Absolutely. And so I think we were one of the first states that actually passed an indoor air law. And so when that was happening, you know, when you're the first, it's I think some compromises were made. And so now there are places that historically don't have a great reputation for being, you know, public health friendly, are passing much better smoke-free air laws than we did in Connecticut. And all of this time, it's been incredibly hard to push back and close those loopholes. And so there was a loophole for any employer with fewer than 5 employees does not need to have this. There's even, by law, you can have like smoking rooms. A lot of employers don't choose to have them because they recognize the challenge and, you know, the need for that. But there are a number of areas and loopholes where this really could improve. And so, again, hopeful. I saw some something on the Department of Public Health's website that they'll be looking into doing this yet again. It's always a bit of a challenge. But I'm hopeful that we can get there this year.
Well, here we are, and this is the second segment of this morning's program that we're going to be mentioning the opening this week of the 2020 Connecticut General Assembly session. We're poised for that to happen this week. Tell us in the last few minutes that we have with you, Ruth, where the American Lung Association and your office is standing in regards to the hardest work that you plan and how our listeners might be able to go to bat with you to try to convey their concern to their legislators and maybe get some traction.
Yeah, great. No, thank you. And so the two major priorities that I think we're going to be looking at is funding and seeing that we can get some of that money that we get into the state actually dedicated to prevention work. I think so many of our schools and other organizations are really trying to make up for that lack of work and doing. There's good work being done in the community, but I think you know, some of those dollars that are coming into the state from the Master Settlement Agreement and revenue from the state, you know, excise taxes on tobacco products should be spent on that. And so importance of just bringing that home and getting some funding dedicated, which is, you know, there's dollars there. I know it's a tough time in Connecticut. It always is. But this is when prevention really can make a big difference. And so we're going to be working on that and seeing where we can go. And then the other thing is that flavored piece. We're just seeing this, you know, when we're talking about 135% like increase in the number of youth who are using these products from 2017 to 2019, just a 2-year time frame, we need to do something. And so while Tobacco 21 was incredibly important, we know that young people still have ways of getting things. And so if we remove that enticement, it can make a big difference. And it's not something that's like completely out there. The federal government did that with other tobacco products, a decade ago. And our neighbors Massachusetts passed it. New York is looking like it's getting there. And even our governor expressed an interest in addressing this kind of regionally. And so I think our neighbors moving this and kind of making it easy to go this route. And so if people are concerned, they, you know, always our website is lung.org and can check out information about the, you know, just impact that tobacco products have on us. And if they're concerned, even wanting to learn about ways to quit, there are, you know, 7 ways that the Food and Drug Administration has approved, you know, as effective ways that people can quit. And so I think sadly there's been too much misinformation about electronic cigarettes and their role in that because they're not approved cessation devices. And now we know that they're really not being used as that because so many young people are being introduced to these products because of, again, cotton candy, apple juice flavored products. And so I think that there's just a lot we can do. So if people want to learn more, I'd encourage them to go to our website, but also talk to their peers and then talk to their lawmakers and let them know if this is something they're concerned about.
Fantastic. Tobacco use is a serious addiction, and Connecticut needs to continue working towards proven measures to prevent and reduce tobacco use, as outlined in the State of Tobacco Control, the American Lung Association's Director of Advocacy here in Connecticut. Ruth Canovi has been our guest on this segment, and if you want to go right to the Connecticut splash page for the Lung Association, you can go to lung.org/CT to find out what you need to know to communicate to your lawmakers as they head into session this week and learn more about what Connecticut is doing right or not doing well in at all in regards to tobacco control. Ruth, thanks again for another informative interview, and we'll be talking to you soon. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.